pieces up. Kevin Burns. All right, let's see if that works. Okay, guys, here he is. Fantastic job. Yes, right here.
Was there anybody that you really wanted to talk to who you couldn't get? It looks like you got just about everybody.
That's right.
Yeah, we got everybody.
You really wanted to say, no, I don't want to talk about it.
No, they better not. Because I'm going to get their free copies. But there was an understandable wariness because some of these people have been talking about Star Wars for years and years and years, and they felt in some ways that they hadn't anything left new to say. But I think that our mandate, and I give Jim a lot of credit for this, was we don't want to ask them the same old questions. We don't want to. In fact, Anthony Daniels was hysterical. Anthony Daniels was the most reluctant, okay? And I had to call him to talk him out of the emotional tree he was in. Because he was like, please, I didn't want to talk about Star Wars. I'm so sick of it. And if you ask me, what was it like to be C-3PO, I will immediately terminate the interview. And I said, trust me, I will not ask you what it was like to be C-3PO. And of course, when I met him in London, my first question was, what was it like to be C-3PO? He said, I warned you about this. Anyway, he was brilliant. We actually sat down with these people, sometimes for 2 and 3 hours. We did in high definition, we shot what we intended to be archival interviews that would stand the test of time and not just service the immediate needs of the documentary. So much so that one of the things that was the most emotional for us was Peter Diamond, who was the stunt coordinator for the Star Wars films, who was this wonderfully vigorous, brilliant raconteur. We had lunch with him. 3 weeks later, he passed away. Which alerted all of us to the importance of what we were doing to chronicle the stories these people had to tell. And it was very much of a mission in that respect, not just a job. Great. Tim, right back there?
Creating a documentary based on existing footage seems like a really daunting task. Did you watch all the archival stuff available and then tailor the interviews after it based on what you knew you had coverage for?
Not really. I mean, first of all, I have to credit that I had a tremendously wonderful team of people. I've been working at 20th Century Fox and doing documentaries of various kinds there for about 10 years. And over the course of time, I've worked with some really, really wonderful people. Edith Becker and her husband Ed Singer. Edith was my co-director and my producer, and her husband Ed was one of the writers. I was able to put together the best editors I'd ever worked with, the best producing people, the best researchers. And they had a tremendously big task. But you really start with the story. In other words, instead of building the documentary around the available footage, what we did is we started with the story. And Jim and I, in our first meeting, were in dead sync about the story we wanted to tell. I'm actually not only a filmmaker, but I was a history major, and I came from a perspective of a social historian. And I was also a filmmaker, a student filmmaker, in Boston at Boston University when the films came out. So I watched them as a film fan, and I was a projectionist working my way through grad school, projecting these movies when they came out. So I wanted to recreate for the audience watching the documentary the experience of watching the films for the first time. And so I said to Jim, I want to bring people back to 1977 because I think people have forgotten what the world was like, what movies were like before this movie, because this movie changed the industry, it changed film schools, it changed everything. And Jim said, you know, we want to tell the story about George Lucas, independent filmmaker. And of course, being an independent filmmaker, I came very much from that same point of view. And in a sense, we put that, you know, front and center as the arc of the story. And everything fell into place. In other words, we really didn't have substantive disagreements about the script or the story or where we were going to go. In fact, it was an embarrassment of riches. The biggest challenge in this production was time. I remember when Jim said to me, how long would a documentary like this with all of the material we're going to make available to you, how long would you need? And I said, I think this was in October when we met, and I said, we need about 6 to 8 months. He said, we have to have it finished in March. And of course, we didn't even have a deal to do it yet. And I looked at my watch. I think I said, well, we better finish, you know, we better hurry up now, because if I don't start it today, we're not going to have it. And we had a team of people just working day and night, flying up to Marin, going to the Lucasfilm archive. I mean, I did the interviews along with Edith, who did a third of them, and Stephen Smith, who did another third, because it was a tag team. When I was in London, you know, Stephen was in Marin and Edith was in Los Angeles, and we were, you know, and I had just left New York. I mean, it was all over the place.
Well, I think another thing too to note is that every time also, I'd go to George with a cut or a draft of the script or anything, he would push us. He'd say, no, this is how it happened, and let's be truthful to that. And, you know, this is the way it went down. And you know, some pretty revealing stuff that you wouldn't think,
Well, the DGA story, I didn't realize the details of that. And I think we went back to that script maybe 3 or 4 times, just trying to make sure, you know, because even though you can watch something like this and say, well, of course, that's the story, but a lot of the nuances of it, a lot of the way you present the information, because even at 2.5 hours, we were cramming an enormous amount of story into a very short amount of time. And so you have to really, I think, you know, my background before I did a lot of this was promotion. And I think what you learn in marketing promotion is how to use words efficiently and effectively, and the power of just a few words in a very short period of time. And even at 2.5 hours, honestly, you know, this thing flies. You know, the people who worked on it were enormously proud of it. And, there was another question.
Okay, Rachel, when we go back, we'll get to you in a sec. Let's go back here.
Actually, that was our mandate. I don't remember, you know, I do tell the dirty little story that the only thing we couldn't put into this documentary was the Star Wars holiday special. which really didn't fit in the cut. We did have it in an early cut, I will tell you. And I was like, gosh, I really want to put that Star Wars holiday special. But it just didn't work in the context of the cut. But we were really encouraged to tell everything. I mean, and you'll see, I mean, you see a little bit in that excerpt, but, you know, poor George gets beaten up pretty heavy in terms of, you know, his relationship to the cast and everything in the first movie, and the idea that no one had any faith in this thing except him, and I would argue Mark Hamill. I mean, Mark, who comes from a place of loving animation, loving fantasy, loving comic books, Mark was on board with it, but other than that, I mean, the other actors and the people in London...
Oh, what? I think the holiday special is severely
underrated. Mark Hamill, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to screen that after.
Yeah, exactly. And every question mark will be about that now.
Anyone else? I would
have a question,
Reagan.
That was your question. Okay, what about Reagan?
I was going to say, how much did you cover the changes or... updates that were made for the re-release in terms of
documents? Just a brief mention at the end. In other words, we certainly acknowledged the special edition and how George went back. I mean, because part of the story, I mean, the real story is George Lucas's journey. Empire of Dreams is really what it, I mean, in fact, the title really fell into place too, because when at the end of the process, the title is just so obvious to us, because so much of the story, to end the story, was how George Lucas, this was a constant struggle. I mean, this whole issue that you guys brought up about the versions of the film and the vision of the film, it was really the process of doing Jurassic Park, working, you know, with ILM and working with Steven Spielberg, that George said, finally the technology has caught up to what I always wanted. Because when you watch the documentary, you'll see that every step of the way in making the first movie, particularly the first movie, was a series of compromises, letdowns, things that he saw in his head that he could not realize given the limited amount of time and budget he had at the time. And so the special edition, and in fact the DVD release, comes closest because, again, the artist's work is never finished. And so as the technology runs apace, and George Lucas has invented most of the technology that has been responsible for these special editions, it's the technology that has come close to, probably still not matched, his imagination and his vision for what he wanted the planets to look like and what he wanted the spaceships and the battle scenes to look like. We did, however, I should note, because as a historian, it was important for us in the telling of the story to put audiences back in that theater seat in 1977, as I was. And so we did get papal dispensation to go back and use the footage from the pre-special edition release. And so when you see in sequences in our story, you see the opening title sequence, because I wanted to go back to Grauman's Chinese Theater for the premiere of the film, and you see the original opening title sequence as it looked in 1977, before it says Episode 4, A New Home. And that was exciting for us, because it was like, yes, that brings you back. But I will say, what was shocking was, and I think this speaks to the whole issue of the restoration, those brief scenes that we use from the pre-special edition, in our mind's eye, they looked a lot better than they do when you go back and revisit them, and you do see how the quality of the print, or the quality of the negative, really doesn't hold up the way you think it might. So you kind of understand why things have been revised and digitally restored.
Okay, one last question. Yes.
Mr. Burns, you're talking about presenting Mr. Lucas as some sort of pioneering rebel, in a sense. Yet, you know, in these movies, the Empire is a bad guy. How does the documentary, The Empire of Dreams, very sinister aspect here.
It's not sinister. It's intentionally ironic. Because even George Lucas mentions in the documentary that there is a strange irony about the fact that he began his journey as a rebel, as an independent. And yet, it's like any other story of a rebel. When they become successful, they become an institution. They become an empire in and of themselves. And he acknowledges that. He said, it's a little strange. I began my filmmaking fighting the big bad corporations, and now here I find myself the head of a corporation. And it's very much the story of Star Wars. You know, in fact, we used to illustrate George's story the scene in Empire where Luke Skywalker goes in to the Dagobah, you know, swamp and fights what he thinks is Darth Vader, and when the helmet comes off, it's Luke's own face. There's a lot of George's story wrapped up in the story of the trilogy, and that's part of the story. I mean, Empire of Dreams, I mean, dreams are not bad things, but, you know, the word empire can take on different meanings, and it very much is that.
Okay, folks. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks so much.